The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 61 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back, welcome aboard. I hope everyone is enjoying the brand new year, 2018. Full disclaimer, I am recording this a week before Christmas. So if a terrible event has happened, I am currently entirely ignorant of its occurrence, and so that is why I am not mentioning it. But hopefully there is no tragedy to mention, and 2018 is starting off nicely. So with that, I will assume that 2018 has started off well and wish you all a happy new year. And I cannot think of a better way to start 2018 than to share this episode with you. There is a mythical man named Taco who often travels throughout the San Gabriels of Southern California, and today he is on this show. That's right, we will be talking to Ryan Taco Dacey. You'll get to start your year off by sitting back and listening to he and I talk about shitty rock, bicycles, Yosemite and the Awani Hotel, which is no longer called the Awani Hotel, what it took to survive Fish Fork, and the bastardly bird known as the Stellar's Jay.
My name is Ryan. People call me Taco from Southern California. Grew up here, moved around a bit, you know. The first thing most people want to, they always ask is, what's with the name Taco? It's boring, it's nothing cool.
I had a feeling you were going to say that,
too. Yeah, well, you know, I've had nicknames that had more value, you know, had something behind them. But this is just, I needed a screen name for stuff on the internet. I had just moved to La Puente not long ago, or West Covina. Down the street in La Puente is a place called Taco del Rio. Really, really good. Took their name and people just shortened it to Taco. And there's always Ryans and Bryans and, you know, climbing and canyoneering and all that jazz. So when you're yelling, you know, especially in like, you know, a crowded Eaton Canyon or something like that, like Ryan, and, you know, you hear like six guys go, yeah, and so it's just Taco, and it's like no one's named Paco or whatever. So it's real quick and easy.
So the way I think I originally met you was probably through Alden.
Mm-hmm.
mutual friend, past guest on the show, dude whose name comes up too much. So if you listen to this show and don't know who Alden is by this point, you must not listen very frequently. But I remember he and Mika talking about some guy named Taco, and then they started arguing about whether that was really your name or not.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes that comes up. It's like, no, seriously. Yeah, some white kid from suburban Los Angeles County, his parents are like, you know what? We'll just name him Taco. That's acceptable. He won't be, you know, ostracized for having an food item as a name.
And I believe it was Mika who was like, no, I'm pretty sure that's really his name.
I'm getting legally changed.
So you're saying his parents chose to name him Taco? Yeah, I think so.
It's, you know, an ethnic name.
Yes, and you're a very ethnic guy.
Oh, yeah, South American, you know, Central American. Definitely.
You're part of the pale, redheaded South American.
The one spot where it doesn't, it gets lots of rain and snow and not a lot of sunlight.
All right, so you took on Taco to use it online, which another thing I find kind of interesting about you is to a certain degree you kind of have like a bit of this counterculture punk rock mystique around you.
Do I?
To a certain degree, would lead me to believe that you would be a person who would hate social media and web forums and things like that, but you use that stuff like crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, traveling around and working odd jobs and stuff, you have plenty of time to do that. It's not like regular 9-to-5 and you fit it in and, you know, you wake up, you get ready, maybe you look at something real quick and then you're out the door and then you're working, maybe on lunch you get a little bit of time, so on and so forth. You know, I'm doing a lot of part-time stuff and working on random stuff. So yeah, especially with travel, you know, you're hooking up with different people in different places. Where am I going to stay? I got to use this to go find out, you know, if I'm going to talk to these people, go here, go there, you know? It's really useful in my situation, but no, I do think in a lot of ways it's not that good because there's no body language. You can joke around with someone in person. And
right.
It's easy to tell if you're being a dick or if you're just messing around and having fun, but online it's almost impossible unless you know those people really well, which is 90% of my online stuff, pure garbage.
That's part of the other thing that I find interesting because you're such a sarcastic, not serious person.
Yeah.
And exactly what you're talking
outwardly.
About. Right. On the inside, you have a strong, powerful heart.
And I don't need no man.
But you definitely have that personality, at least outwardly or whatever, and online with the sarcasm and the humor. And it is so hard to get that stuff across to someone that doesn't already know you.
Oh, yeah. And people get hurt about it, but, you know.
And then it hurts you in your little heart.
Yeah.
You pretend on the outside.
And crumbling.
Pretend on the outside.
Use the memes to medicate.
That's also one of your forms of communication, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Gabe and Luis and all them, it's pretty much just through memes that we communicate.
Yeah, so if you don't know Ryan and you find him online, you will not understand anything that he is relaying because it'll be an inside joke, a meme, or some sort of sarcastic comment that maybe you're not privy to.
No one's meant to understand, but most things you can't quite fully understand anyway, so the relativity of the universe leaks into every single aspect of communication as well.
Oh yeah, this thing's going to get deep quick.
Yeah, and I'm sober.
So let's talk about this. So when I think of Ryan Dacey, other than pale, redheaded South American guy named Taco, I think of a dude that apparently travels solely by bicycle.
Usually.
A guy that climbs a lot of stuff, occasionally gets forced to do some canyoneering, and a guy that notoriously likes to climb things that no one else would ever want to climb. I don't know if you know this, so I'm going to reveal it to you now.
Oh, God.
I'm curious if you do, because after climbing with you a while back and getting a feel for like the kind of stuff you like and the kind of routes you've set, I've started referring to like those routes in between designated routes that look terrible and chossy and like nothing anyone would ever want to climb. I call those Dacey routes.
Oh, great.
And anytime I say that around someone who knows you, I never have to explain what
I
mean.
Yeah, I can grasp that. A lot of that just has to do with, like, for example, I'm assuming that meant, like, Holcomb Valley, where we climbed.
Yeah, that was where we climbed last time.
Because a lot of the routes there are bolted, but one of my kind of things that I like to do when I go there, because I had already climbed most of the bolted routes that, you know, we had climbed or whatever, is to look for something that is somewhat challenging, that from the ground you look up and you see if you can protect it, and it's usually kind of run out because it's not like, you know, Yosemite or Sierra, you know, like, you got a splitter crack, and then you move over here, and you got a slab, and yada, yada, yada. You can kind of look up at it and think, okay, I'll put a tiny nut here and a small cam there, and then I've got big stuff, and then I can hang and do this. You map it out in your head. That's what I like the most about it. Like, I don't really like sport climbing because it's just kind of like I'm trying to be risky, but like there's no risk, and for me there's very little reward. It's kind of like I don't have to think. When you have to protect something creatively that's not a gimme, that you don't know anything about, that you're just on there right now and you have to figure it out in what could in theory be a stressful position, that engages a lot more of you as an animal than, you know, just like, okay, go up clip, here's the crux, pull hard clip. clip, and then you're done. Not that, I'm not trying to bash, you know, those kinds of things. I'm just saying, like, I'm trying to distill it or, you know, BS for my purposes.
I've noticed that. It seems like what you're interested in is solving that puzzle. You don't want the fucking video game, I don't even know what they're called anymore because they don't make them anymore, but you don't want the video game strategy guide that tells you
how to get, I know what you're talking about,
Link to here. Yeah. They're great when...
like Duke Nukem 3D and stuff, those era, that era.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking old people stuff that no one has needed in over a decade. But yeah, it definitely seems like you're a person who doesn't want the answers before you get on the rock.
Correct. I like to know nothing about it. I don't like to know the grade. I like to look at it and kind of figure out, okay, you know, what I think it'll be like. And then I go up there and those stressors and all those factors come together to allow me to meditate.
There's a certain amount of confidence and skill and experience that needs to come before you can decide to do that, because you could easily be an inexperienced person with very little skill and throw yourself on something like that and then get in terrible trouble right away.
Yeah, and often with the routes that I have climbed, if I didn't have that experience beforehand, especially with regards to the stuff in the San Gabes, which is often difficult to protect, and the protection itself when you find it is often iffy, so if you do fall, it is very likely that it will pull out and it will change, you know, your future for months or perhaps years, because you will probably break things and you might die. That's pretty important for all of that. You have to have a good balance. You have to be able to quiet the voices in your head down really well. There's like a 5'10", or it's probably more like a 9, I don't know, over in above Crystal Lake, not the crag, but the wall that I don't think anybody goes to, but it's higher quality rock there than at the crag. Crag's mostly crap, unfortunately. But there's a line, I think we called it Attack of the Clowns, and it goes up this really cool dihedral. It's like a 5'7 to an oak tree. Really easy. It's really fun. Go around the oak tree, and then you go up, and it's like a 5'9 or like a 10A, a dihedral with a tiny little roof and a weird bulge thing. And the first time I tried it, I backed off of it. I think I might have down-aided, but it's balancey. It's just shy of vertical. And it looks like there are cracks from the ground, but when you get up to them, instead of them being like, you know, half inch cracks that you could put like a 0.4 or 0.5 cam in, they're usually about, what do we say that is? It's like 8 to 10 millimeters, and everything has moss on it and lichen. And so all of where you're standing is, like if you cleaned all that stuff off, it would be a lot easier, I think. But the protection is still iffy, and almost all the protection is very small. And the crux, it would be easy to peel off backwards and tear it out and land on the ledge, and your belayer. Sorry, we're being tracked by Obama. Obama's trying to sneak up and gain all the secrets for the FUBU death camps. You're trying to make us make wallets. I refuse to. But yeah, like experience gained aid climbing really helped with that, because with aid climbing, for hours, you're just in aiders trying to figure out, oh, is this tiny little nothing going to work? And you get on it, and sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't, and you fall, and it rips out, and this, that, and the other, hits you in the face, whatever. You know, you just hours and hours and hours of doing that, and then going up to a place like that, which has better rock than I think anybody who hasn't been there thinks it does, but it's still certainly not, you know, like Joshua Tree or Yosemite or Red Rocks or any place with good rock.
It also has a super shitty approach.
Oh, that approach is worse than the other approach. So the one that's famous for being bad, this is twice as bad, but it's not really that bad. It's kind of like if you're going up to the base of Zodiac on El Cap, it's shorter than that, but it's still the same long, about half an hour to 45 minute talus and scree field. And so it kind of gets old, but after you've done it a half dozen times, it's like, oh, whatever.
Yeah, so you're mentioning Crystal Lake area, which is one of the climbing areas that you've helped develop and put up a number of first descents there. The one that comes to mind is Conveniently Sexy.
Oh, Conveniently Sexy, yeah, that was
one that I've climbed
on. One.
So we talked kind of about how you like to climb on stuff or you really have to think about it. Mm-hmm. And we've talked a little bit now about these areas that you've helped develop. So before you could get to the point where you could do all those things, let's go back in time to how you built up that skill base, because you grew up, like you said, down here in Southern California. Mm-hmm. Were you an outdoor kid, or was that something that came later?
Yeah, I was an outdoorsy kid. Should I just start from kind of the beginning? And
just start from the beginning. Start about when your parents first locked eyes and they could feel you in their loins.
Yeah, oh, I don't even want to think about most of that, but my parents are from northern New Jersey, New York City area. My family's from back east, you know, not outdoorsy at all. Nobody's outdoorsy. My dad was a car salesman and an aerospace engineer, and my mom was a mom, and she did some nursing and stuff like that. So I kind of grew up around, like, cars and a little bit of racing and stuff like that, and I went and hiked a lot, and I wanted to learn how to hunt, and I wanted to join the military when I was in high school, so I joined the NRA and the Civilian Marksmanship Program, and that all came together, and that I wanted to train, so I went into the hills near my house. It's near Chino Hills area. So you know how it's kind of hilly and there aren't, well, not anymore. I mean, a lot of it's been smashed and developed and sold for millions of dollars in crappy houses that are 5 feet away from each other. You know what I mean?
But looking to purchase one of those in the near future?
Oh, absolutely. I can't wait to be where it used to be nice and quiet and I used to hang out. But yeah, I'd hike with one of my sisters and then she was busy. And so I just went out and hiked alone. So I've been hiking and sleeping outdoors alone and hunting and scrambling around and exploring ever since I was 10. I don't know. Since I was a little kid, you know, my parents didn't really care. They were like, yeah, go out. I always came home and I didn't shoot anybody. So it was cool. They trusted me with a lot and I haven't hurt anybody. So that's cool.
It's interesting because a lot of times, like Southern California, everybody assumes Los Angeles. And so there's this concept that everyone here is like granola hippie, liberal city dweller. And your upbringing to a certain degree is very similar to more like a Southern upbringing.
Well, I don't know about Southern. You mean as far as like hunting and stuff?
As far as you ran off on your own to do the things you wanted to do. People trusted you to do it. And maybe they even trusted you with weaponry at a young age.
You know, I'd have a rifle with me and I was like 13, 14 years old. And that's unheard of. And that was when school shootings were really coming into vogue. That was kind of a challenging thought process. It's much different. I mean, where I grew up is predominantly Asian neighborhood, predominantly higher end. I was just middle class. We were in a middle class neighborhood. But, you know, it was all like everybody wants to be doctors and lawyers. And I wanted to be a soldier and just kind of be simple or whatever. I don't know what the hell I wanted. I was a dumb kid. You know, everybody's a dumb kid.
Thankfully, now you're an ancient wise.
Now I'm a dumb kid with more problems.
So you were a kid running around by yourself with a gun in the woods.
Yep. But I didn't get into climbing until I was probably about like 19, 20 years old. 32 now, for what it's worth. I started by going up Baldy. I think the first time I started hiking up kind of near Baldy, over in the hills above Claremont and Upland, I would look far off and I'm like, oh, I hate mountains. How the hell do I get over there? And so I went hiking further up. I went up Thunder Mountain once, just up one of the ski runs. I didn't know anything about anything. And so I had myself, and I think I had desert boots on, and there was snow on the ground, and it was icy because it's the San Gabe's, so the snow just turns to ice. And I got to the top of the ski lift on Thunder Mountain by getting a Navy survival knife that I brought and jamming it into the snow, and then I'd pull myself up to a stance. I repeated it for probably not that far, but you know, far enough to get through that part.
So, got up so homemade ice axe.
Yeah, and then went around the front side of it underneath the lift to the summit of Thunder, and then I thought, oh, I'll just glissade down, not knowing anything about glissading and not understanding that I was on incredibly compacted snow and it was cold. And so I slid and I lost control and I slid all the way down the mountain, all the way to the base of the ski lift for like a couple thousand feet of elevation loss and quarter of a mile of distance. Thought I was gonna die, went through a couple dead trees and just, I saw them coming up and then it was just, oh, they're gone now, and that was it. Time took me somewhere else. And then the next day, I think I went to REI and I bought a Black Diamond ice axe, which I still use occasionally, and some crampons. Went out and did that and started climbing steeper stuff like North Face of Telegraph and just finding the steepest stuff and climbing that. And then there was rock, so I needed to learn how to climb rock. And so I taught myself how to like climb.
And are you pretty much entirely self-taught for all these things?
Mostly self-taught. A lot of it from soloing and like gear soloing or lead soloing, whatever you want to call it. Like I would do stuff and then people have over time corrected my mistakes. So I've never had enough money to just, you know, I can't just go plunk down $700 for a class because I don't have much money. So I was always kind of just, you know, hanging out with people and they teach me things and I teach them things and it just grew from there. My medical training obviously is a professional training.
What sort of medical training are we talking about?
Like Whiffer.
Okay, so you've got
nothing crazy.
You've got the full Whiffer 10-day.
Very expensive. Okay. Thanks to my friends, they paid for it.
Woofer being, for those that don't know, wilderness first responder, which is like the next level after wilderness first aid, which is instead of 2 days, it's 10 right?
Days,
it's 10 in comprehensive days with tests and studying.
And you live there. And it was pretty cool. I liked it a lot. But it is very expensive. And I'm finding that trying to get certified as a rock guide is outrageously expensive. And I think it's wrong. And I really do think it's stupid that if you look at a lot of guides, a lot of people living in vans, and it's like it costs more to do this than it does for lawyers to get a lot of their things. To be able to work in certain areas, bar aside. $1,200 or something like that is the highest price. And $750, I think, is the lowest for Whiffer. You got to have that. You got to have it every 2 years. And then SPI, single pitch instructor, that's like $750. You got to re-up that. And then you got to do all these other dues and stuff. Like, you're a guy, dude. Where's this money coming
from?
Right.
It's not absurd. It's not like you're a lawyer charging $300 an hour for a consultation.
Yeah. I think it's absurd. But what am I going to do about it, you know?
Is that a goal for you? Is that what you're
aiming
for?
Yeah, that's what I'm going towards. But, you know, life is life. If I find a better paying job or something that allows a good balance in life and allows me to be close to my people, then I'll do that. Keep working towards it, but at a slower pace. You know what I mean?
You're talking about becoming a certified guide. So someone that could be hired through like American Alpine Institute or something
like
that.
Yeah, or Exum or Yosemite Mountaineering School or just anybody. But like AMGA Rock Guide. And there's three. There's Rock Guide, Alpine Guide, and Ski Guide. And to have all three, you can become a international mountain guide. So you can go guide, you know, whatever.
It makes a lot of sense to me that you'd be interested in that, because one thing that we haven't mentioned yet that also I've noticed with you is that you take a lot of other less experienced people out. Especially, I've noticed you take a lot of female people out.
Yeah, you know, it feels really good to introduce people to it. And as time has gone by, I have noticed how you do things imprints on other people. So you might notice someone that you introduced to the sport, say, 10 years ago or something like that. And you might see some things that they're doing that you might think, that's not very safe. That's not a good habit. And then you realize it's like a mirror. It's a reflection of how you were at the time. So there's kind of that maturity aspect of it. But it feels good to introduce people to stuff like that. And I think it's important for people to realize that in our civilization as it is, a lot of it is bad for you as a person and as an animal. I mentioned that a lot, and that a lot of mental health problems and a lot of depression and drug use and all kinds of stuff. I think a lot of that comes from not being able to experience stuff outside, I guess you could say, because for thousands and thousands of years, we've been outside and hunting and gathering and what have you. And now we're just like robots, and we're just in a society where you just work for money and 70-hour weeks and get like 3 hours of sleep and all this stuff. And then, oh, well, you can take these pills to counteract this thing, and then this pills for this thing. And all it does is I watch people that I love fall apart and die and have all these problems from it. It's fucked up. And so I like to show people, you know, you can go outside and you don't need to take drugs. I mean, I don't give a shit if you smoke pot or, you know, shrooms or whatever the hell you do, or drink a little bit. But it's like so many people don't seem to know that they can go out and do that. They can go climb, they can go canyoneering. Canyoneering is real easy to get into, not to say that it isn't without risks. And you get to be around your friends, you know, your people, and you get to share these experiences, and you build a lot from it. You're under stress, you work together, yada, yada, yada. It's really good, you know?
To a certain degree, what you're talking about is something that comes up on this show a lot. And I was one of those people, not that was living off of prescription drugs and stuff, but one of those people that grew up not thinking. Like, I grew up in the South, so I was outside a fair amount, but a lot of the activities I do now were things I didn't think were available to me. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, climbers, that's something that like these advanced athletes do, and
extreme.
I can never do that. Right.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I lived out here and finally decided to let me really look into that I found out, oh shit, there's like all kinds of opportunities and all sorts of levels of interaction with those things that you can do. And I agree with you that I think it makes a huge difference. And I do wonder how many people, if they just found some sort of thing they were passionate about that allowed them to push themselves in an uncomfortable way outside, would not become drug addicts or other things.
Because it would give them an outlet that is physical, which is really important, and mental and spiritual and emotional and all that stuff. Because we're all animals, and going outside and exercising and being under stress and figuring things out and surviving is what we've been doing for a gajillion years until recently. And now we don't have to do anything. And, you know, anyone can reproduce, and everybody can be homeless or this, that, or the other, or be on drugs, whatever it is, you know what I mean? It's just everything's been turned upside down. There's no survival of the fittest. There's no reward.
One of the things I wonder is, and I don't know how much of it is living on the West Coast now and just what's readily available around me, but I wonder if that is starting to shift a little bit, because it seems like outdoor recreation, the industry at the very least, is ballooning.
Yeah, it seems to be getting big.
Yeah, and it also seems like it's more and more people who I never thought would camp or hike or do whatever are starting to get into it. And I don't know if that is just going to be a temporary trend.
I think so. I mean, wasn't like running and kung fu really popular in the 70s? Who does kung fu anymore, you know? MMA was really popular. Climbing right now is really popular. I know it's hypocritical to say, but I do hope it becomes less popular in the future for selfish motives, really. Just because I think it's more pure when there aren't so many people.
Well, there are enough gyms popping up that most of those people will be in the gyms where you don't have to worry about them.
Yeah, but again, I think it's all selfish. I think I'm completely wrong with it, I hope. I mean, the same thing with bike stuff, too. Like, a whole adventure biking and bikepacking thing, that's really big now, and I didn't know anything about it when I was, you know, riding a lot. And then, you know, when I started getting into touring, I kind of didn't know about it until probably about a year ago, and now it's a big focus for me just because it makes more sense. But it's expensive, so I have to sell all my old crap to get the new crap.
So before we do get to bike packing, I want to hit one more thing with climbing before we talk about that. So you were saying how you're self-taught in a lot of ways, and then you would pick up things from other people. It's one thing to be self-taught, you know, and doing scrambling up mountain faces or top roping somewhere or bouldering. It's another thing once you start getting into traditional gear placing climbing.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that transition go for you? Because just jumping into that with no sort of instruction could lead to injury right away.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm surprised I'm still here. I didn't think I would live all that long, but, you know, a lot of it, I think, stems from not having much money. So I'd have to climb in the San Gabes, and there's not much climbing in the San Gabes, and there certainly aren't very many sport routes. Because, I mean, when you're starting off and all you got is some draws, you know, and a rope, what are you going to do? You know, so I bought nuts and hexes and stuff like that and acquired some tri-cams. And I think I had one cam that I got from Bass Pro Shops a long time ago.
Bass Pro Shop?
Yeah. Because, yeah, well, they don't know what it is. They're looking at it, you don't know what this is. You know, and it's, sorry, offensive.
Speaking of places selling camming devices that maybe aren't fully aware of what they're doing with them, although not to the degree probably of Bass Pro Shop, but when Sports Chalet was still around, the one over here in La Cañada, you could buy cams there. And I went in one day and you know those tags to make the alarms go off so you can't steal items that you usually punch through clothing?
Yeah.
They had punched it through the sling on the cam.
Criminy.
Yeah.
There's no way. Probably not a big deal, but still, come on.
You're physically injured. You're like injuring the thing that
compromised the strength of the sling. I guess that was not a climber doing that.
No, it definitely wasn't. But the next time I came back in, I noticed they were no longer doing that.
I like doing that. It's like, oh, hey, I see things have changed.
That was a positive change.
That's cool.
So you bought those things, but how did you figure out how to use them? You just trial and error?
Yeah, I think
so.
Send
yourself
up
something?
Hard to say. A lot of it was done in winter on like steep faces in the San Gabes. Like I remember going to road cuts or things like that and just learning how to place protection. And I had Freedom of the Hills, and then I bought a couple of other books. And I used to read a lot as a little kid. And so I would just read a lot and I would look at the book and I would use that as instruction. I didn't have anybody there to help me because, you know, everybody else was like, oh, I'm busy, this, that, and the other. And I didn't really have a whole lot of, I had friends, but I didn't have any climbing friends back then. You know, it was just me and like maybe one other person. So, you know, I didn't have any real options as far as I saw.
It's kind of like whoever you could get to go out and belay you and come along.
And oftentimes it was like they were probably only a little bit more experienced than I was. Like, oh, well, you know, I've climbed like 5'7" outside on sport. And me, I was like, oh, you know, I've climbed a lot of snowy cold things by myself and I know how to tie a figure eight sometimes.
So did you kind of just slowly climb up things where you occasionally had to place a piece of gear, or did you decide one day, all right, today's the day I'm going to go climb something fully on gear and I'm going to figure it out?
My biggest project for a long time when I was getting into things was just steep faces in the San Gabes in winter. I'd climb part of the West Face Couloir, which I have listed as One Nut Wonder on Telegraph Peak. That's got the crux pitch, if you want to call it. That's like a 5'7", because it's normally frozen waterfall that's delaminated, and as soon as you hit it, it just disintegrates. We protected that a couple of times, and you might find yourself in a position like that, but further up a route where it's like, oh, I can't really back down, so I gotta solo it or figure it out. There's been a bunch of those.
So based on what you've told me so far, I'm gonna make a guess here and you tell me if this is accurate. I know that you establish routes sometimes, you know, do first descent sometimes. Was a lot of that just out of sheer necessity? Like, oh, there's not anywhere to climb necessarily right by me, but I know there are these rocks here that no one else seems to be climbing. Maybe there's a route there.
Yeah,
I'll go
probably
figure it out. Is that how Crystal Lake came around?
I'm trying to remember how Crystal Lake really started. I think I went up there. I might have ridden my bike up from the city and looked at it and thought, oh, that looks neat. And then, you know, it's one of those things where you see something in the distance, but you can't go there because you have to go back home or you got work or whatever. And then you make a plan to go out there again. And you go out there again, and maybe you don't bring any gear. You just want to look at it. And then the next time you bring out some gear, but you don't have the right gear. And then another time you come out, you know, just progressively doing that.
So when you've established routes, I notice that you tend to add them to Mountain Project and share them. Whereas some people maybe would be of the opinion that, oh, I went and established this, no one ever should know about it, it's mine. So that does not appear to be your logic. So what's your reasoning for sharing those things with other people?
There is that. That's kind of the more old school way, is to not tell anybody, but it depends on a different geographic area. Some people in certain areas will share a lot. Some people won't share anything at all. I think that it's kind of selfish not to share things. I'm not saying that you need to share everything or that you should share anything. I mean, it's absolutely relative. You know what I mean? It doesn't really matter too much. And the stuff that I'm climbing up there, most of that stuff, you really expect that to get crowded. It's not like people are going to go up there and go on some run out hairy route.
Refer back to my earlier comments about what I'd call a Dacey route.
Yeah, no one's getting in line. There are a few up there that are quite good, honestly, that I would climb over and over again until I die, because they're just fun or they're engaging or whatever. But for the most part, I mean, most people avoid loose rock. Psh, go to Yosemite, people avoid Glacier Point Apron because of the chance of rock fall or bad rock here or bad rock there, you know? And it's like that stuff is like top tier stuff compared to what I'm climbing, you know? And you look at the British, a lot of those guys are really good at bad rock. And I think if you're going to be climbing mountains in general, you need to be confident on bad rock, because oftentimes you'll be doing what, you know, you call it first ascent, or you're just going climbing. You look at a mountain, you think, okay, that looks like a good line today because the conditions over here are dangerous. That stuff's melted out. So you do that one line and I've never been up there. You've never been up there, whatever. You don't know. If you get up to something and you don't have the confidence to climb something with either big loose blocks or maybe some kitty litter on it, what are you going
to
do?
It's interesting because you're kind of getting to a point that we weren't talking about, but I think you've inadvertently made a really good point, which one of the things with multi-pitch and longer climbing is you can get yourself into trouble trying to find the route.
Yeah, if you get off route.
Right, and sometimes maybe it is better to just look at it and say, well, this looks like something that would be good for me, mm-hmm. as opposed to, well, where does this topo tell me to go?
That's
Am
how
I in
the
climb right
most
place?
Things,
yeah,
too. Because it's most of the time you stick on like an old route, especially if it's an old route that's a classic. It might follow a line that's not as fun. Maybe you want it. Maybe it's like a 5.7. There's a 5.9 pitch to the left that looks way cooler. And like, nah, I'm not going to do it because it's not on the piece of paper. And I climb with a lot of people who are very beta intensive. And they stick with that and they follow it and go by the book. But I've always throughout my life really been opposed to things that are by the book. I hate that kind of like, we have to stick with it because someone else did it. It's more like move like water through it, you know, just be fluid and figure it out as you go. You know, if both you guys can manage something, which obviously isn't always the case, you know, sometimes you bring your follower up something they're uncomfortable with. And I apologize to everybody for having done that 8 million times, but you know, just go with the flow. It's climbing, for crying out loud. It's not like you're at work and you have to like do everything by the book.
I think for me, a lot of the times, like if I'm trying to follow a route, I want to adhere to it partly sometimes out of like this sense of not history, but just I want to experience the same thing that the person that set this up did to a certain degree. And then other times it's a lack of confidence in my ability to climb what may be next to it. Should I get off route?
Same.
Well, you don't seem to have that fear.
I wig out on stuff sometimes. I mean, first day I went to Yosemite when I went to move there for work, I had to get rescued by Yosar on Glacier Point Apron because I went up kind of by the Garak, but further to the right. I looked up this dihedral, and it was all low angle, but I had never climbed in Yosemite, and I had never been on glacier-polished slab, mm-hmm. and it's really squeaky. You know, I think I was in approach shoes as usual. They make the most sense, you know? And I went up it thinking, that looks class 4. And it was probably about 5.7, 5.8, and I got up to a ledge, and I stayed there, and I yelled for help, and they placed two bolts and lowered me down, and I felt like an idiot, and that was my first day. And then I remember climbing at Church Boulders, Aunt Fanny's Pantry, I think it is. It's a 5.4 up to a tree, which nowadays I could easily scramble that whole thing many times while probably blackout drunk and with a concussion and a million other problems. But then I couldn't. I had to back off of that. It also depends on areas too, because like if you hadn't climbed there, you could be, you know, a strong climber in Red Rocks. You go to Yosemite, you're like, I'm not used to this, and it would just wig you out. And maybe you need a break. You need to do more training or whatever.
Yeah, there's definitely a huge difference based on style of rock and quality of rock on confidence. There's something about Joshua Tree that incites me to fear more quickly than Yosemite, Red Rock, any of those places, and I'm not sure what it is. I think it's strictly the rock quality, something about the rock quality, and this idea that everything is sandbagged.
Yeah, well, most of it is sandbagged. A lot of like 5.4s there that would be 5.7s, maybe 5.8s everywhere else.
Right.
I've only recently got my confidence up in Joshua Tree, and I always said I hated it. I used to visit there a lot as a little kid, you know, go off-roading, but no climbing, and then I got there, and I was like, whoa, it's pretty sandbagged.
Yeah, it totally is.
It's weird how much friction you get. It's disconcerting how much friction you get. I'm not used to that. I'm used to it being like you have to balance really well.
If I go up on some easy, quote-unquote easy route in Joshua Tree that's like 5.4 or 5.5, I will inevitably reach a point that requires a short traverse with terrible feet that would drop me onto a ledge.
And then you'd have broken ankles, right. And you'd be out of work for a while, and everything would suck.
Yeah, and for some reason that happens all the time. So I've done multiple routes in Joshua Tree where I hit that point, and I sit there for like 20 minutes trying to build the courage
and
to cross
like,
this traverse.
Maybe we could do this. Oh, wait, hold on, go back.
yep.
Go over here. There you go back. Okay, my arms are pumping out. Okay, relax my arms, lean in. Oh, crap. Okay, there goes a foot. Yeah, the usual dialogue.
Yeah, so that's Joshua Tree. So you mentioned moving to Yosemite or to that area. So what brought you up there?
Well, my girlfriend at the time helped me get a job. I ended up working at the Awani, which is now called the Super Majestic Whatever Hotel, after Delaware North stupidly took the rights or whatever to the names, which is retarded.
For those that don't know what he's talking about, was it been 2 years now?
Something like that. 2 or 3, whatever it was.
It's like the company that handled the concessions and various other things for the park.
was Delaware North, and then Aramark, which they do like clothing, and I think they do prison stuff, like prison food.
And the previous company, for some reason, owned the copyrights
to the names.
And so Curry Village
is now Half Dome Village.
But you can still see the Curry Village sign, but there's like a tarp over it.
It's kind of like, yes, we're divorced. We're not using your father's name anymore.
Right. Yeah, and the Awani has become...
The Majestic, which is stupid, because if you've ever been in the bowels of the Awani and had to make the freight elevator work and get the ringtails out of the six-story, you know, closets and stuff, it's not Majestic. It's just a hotel. I mean, it's a nice place, but they charge way too much.
We can't just gloss over this. You have to tell us a little bit about the experience of working in the posh hotel in Yosemite Valley. Start wherever you think makes sense.
Oh, man. Okay.
You want to start with the original tribes being massacred by the U.S.
Yosemite. I don't remember a whole lot about what all that meant, but yeah.
But really, what did you do there?
I was housekeeping at first, which is just, you know, making beds, cleaning toilets, you know, cleaning up after people.
And living in the valley, correct?
Yeah, lived in a couple of the different dorms. Like if you go to the main market in the village, I've lived behind that, across the street from that, down the street from that, and around like that. You know, you get all kinds of different housing. Some of it sucks, some of it's really nice, and some of it's hard to get.
And how long were you working there?
I think like 8 months to a year.
8 months?
After I quit, I lived in Half Dome. Yes, very difficult. I lived in Camp 4 for a month or so. Then I finally left when I got really, really, really sick. Yeah.
So this was fairly recently.
Yeah, so I did housekeeping. It was cool for a while, you know, because you're like, oh, shit, I live in Yosemite. This is tight. I can look at things and climb stuff. Then it's like, okay, I'm really tired of cleaning the diarrhea that somehow managed to find its way on the wall and ceiling. Nobody gives you tips unless they're poor, because poor people seem to give the most, even though they have the least. So I said, hey, can I do something else? And so my manager lady, she hooked me up with doing, like, lobby porter stuff. So I'd, like, sweep, deliver papers, de-ice the walkways, set the fires in the whatever they call the main hall, the grand hall, the super glorious, whatever the heck. Maintenance, valet, a little bit of everything. Running around, being busy, setting up their Bainbridge. Or Bainbridge, is that the name of their Christmas or Thanksgiving festival where they dress up all funny and it costs a lot of money?
I would not know. I have only driven past the Awani.
Don't,
that has
don't
been my entire relationship with, excuse me, whatever, the Majestic, whatever.
Yeah, the big one.
So
big expensive boy.
Yeah, so what did your life look like while you were there? Were you working 5 days a week? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, like four or five.
So 4 or 5 days a week, and then...
And then when I changed my schedule, it became less of like a 6 a.m. to 3 or 4 p.m. thing into a, always call a shotgun schedule, because it looks like you just got to loaded some bird shot and shot at a calendar and whatever it hit, that's where
you
worked.
Right.
And it's all over the place. So I, you know, sometimes start work at like 1 a.m. and get off when it's, you know, 8. A lot of my shifts were early in the morning because I have to deliver stuff or clean the cottages. That's a crappy job. And the squirrels and the damn Steller's Jays, they steal all your stuff. I hate Steller's Jays, my least favorite species of bird. But, you know, just kind of all over the place. And that screwed with me. And then moving around from different places and having different roommates and then living with my girlfriend at the time. And it got bad and I got depressed and I needed to get out of there. And I guess what I have to say about all that is if you do plan on living there and you're not in your late teens, early 20s, I would suggest having a van so that you could sleep in that, because sometimes you get roommates and maybe they're cool, but a lot of them are just drunk kids from the valley who don't climb. A lot of people there don't climb. I don't get it. And they're really messy and they've got bad habits and they're undisciplined. And I just like to be quiet when I'm home and, you know, cook and keep it simple. And
it's interesting because I'm sure before you headed there, you had this picture in your mind like, oh, it's going to be awesome. I'm going to be in Yosemite and I'll be able to climb everything every day and I'm going to be able to do it. And you had these expectations. But then you said you got out of there because things were getting bad. It was driving you crazy and you were getting depressed.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure is not at all what you expected to happen.
And that's a one good point that I got from all that is people say, you live in the dream, man, paradise. And it's like, if you're in a bad state of mind, you're depressed, it doesn't matter where you are. I can look up all these big walls and I'm like, I really want to climb rhombus walls, stare up at that for an hour. It doesn't matter because you're depressed. Nothing's possible. You don't feel good. Everything just feels like crap.
Were you able to accomplish any of the things you wanted to early on, or did it get bad kind of right away?
When I quit, I didn't know what I was going to do or where I was going to go or how I would have a place to stay afterwards, and so I kind of freaked out and I felt hopeless, and I rarely cry, but I cried a little bit on a walk.
It's all right. Nobody listens to this podcast, so nobody
knows. No, it's cool. I'm trying to cry more. Don't worry, guys. I've got this. I'm in touch with some of my feelings. But then when I lived in Camp 4, it was really cool. It was simple, and I had enough money left over where I could, you know, I just had my car in the parking lot with all my crap in it. I went out. I was just climbing a lot of stuff, and previous to that, when I was working probably about a couple months before that. I had never really free soloed in my life, but I had been climbing a lot. It's hard to find partners, and gear soloing or lead soloing and aid soloing all take a lot of time and a lot of equipment, and it kind of sucks a lot of the fun out of it. One day I was like, maybe tomorrow I'm going to go see what I can free solo. So I did a bunch of easy stuff at Swan's Lab, and it built up, and I started soloing all kinds of stuff. You know, pretty easy stuff, nothing crazy, but a lot of like multi-pitches. That's probably the best thing I've done, one of the best things I've done in my life.
Let's take a minute to talk about that, because soloing is one of those things that most people can't understand the reasoning behind it. Even people who see like climbers and think like, oh, that looks cool, that looks fun, I understand the drive for that. Free soloing's stupid, no one should ever do it.
It's irresponsible, you're selfish, if you get hurt, people have to help you, and if you die, so on and so forth.
But you brought up another point, which is you were saying that was some of the best stuff you've done. What a lot of people say is it's freeing. It's pure climbing.
It is purity, and it's pure movement. And it's I've never really danced. You know, I never went to dances in high school, and I don't have anybody to show me how to dance, you know. But this is part of my dancing. Of course, there's risk, but if there's no risk, you're probably not paying attention.
The thing I've started to realize the more I climb, at least when you're leading on gear, to a certain degree, you are soloing.
Yeah, but there is a backup. I always have like this little LED or LCD display somewhere deep in my head that says, if I fall here, nothing happens. If I fall here, I'm going to bang my head, but I'll be okay. If I fall here, I'm going to hurt my ankle, but I'll be good for a week. If I fall here, I'm shattering both of my ankles and I'm going to have to quit my job. I don't have any medical help. I'm going to be screwed for like a year and then I got to rebuild and it's going to really suck for a long time. If I fall here, I'm going to die and that's going to screw my family over. It's going to disappoint a lot of people, so on and so forth.
But even on rope, there are those times where you know, okay, here falling is not an option.
Oh, that's what I mean on rope. I'm talking about on rope.
Oh yeah, you're talking about on rope. Right, yeah. Exactly. And so you're dealing with that already, and then once you remove the rope, there's no backup whatsoever. But you're already kind of in that mindset, so it kind of starts to naturally happen to you, whether you mean it to or not.
Well, the dialogue's different without a rope. It's kind of just you accept that you can't make any mistakes because people are relying on you. And so you have to take everything very seriously. And I know a lot of people who don't solo in that fashion. And again, I'm not doing anything crazy or cutting edge. It's almost all like below 5'8 kind of stuff. Just pretty easy, but there are real consequences and they're going to affect more than just you. And it's not a good thing and you need to be responsible. It's not just, I am responsible for my life. It's like, I am responsible for this. And, you know, who's going to take care of my mom? And who's going to make sure that my sister's okay and my other sister? And you know, my whole family, and make sure everything's good and make sure all this stuff gets done. And all that hinges on you in that one moment, however long that moment may be. So a lot of people probably think it's like it's irresponsible or something like that, but it's absolutely not.
And I think that's kind of what I was trying to get at as well. As before, when I was just top roping and bouldering and stuff like that, I always thought like free soloing is a thing I'll never do. And then once I started leading on gear, I would find sometimes I accidentally soloed a pitch because I didn't realize I was already at the top of it. Mm-hmm. And it was moving so smoothly that it seemed like
flowing.
It seemed like it made no sense to stop and try to place a piece when it wasn't necessary, it wasn't needed, and I could move through it much more quickly without. I'd get to top of pitch and say, oh shit, I guess I just soloed that.
Yep, and then you just build your anchor. And
and then you start to understand how it can start to make sense and how sometimes, not always, sometimes it's maybe more safe to not stop and place gear.
In some cases, there are simply fewer systems in place. There are fewer things to go wrong, fewer mistakes to make when it's just movement than if there's technical stuff involved.
Basically, what I want to get at is don't give Taco Dacey Ryan a hard time for soloing. Don't draw assumptions about the irresponsibility of people who choose to do it. And also, don't think that you'll never do it.
Never say never for a lot of things in life.
Because it may start to make sense to you.
Yeah, and it's not for everyone. There are plenty of people who are significantly better climbers than you or me or anyone we know who will
combined.
Never solo. Yeah, like I'll never free solo. That's their choice. It's cool, you know. That's been gone over a lot. People talked about that a lot. It's all just very personal. But realistically speaking, if you want to move in the mountains, you're going to have to be comfortable soloing fifth class terrain, and that's in your head. You need to be in your head, and you need to be in control of your head. It's the same with riding in traffic or being in a fight or whatever it is. You got to be able to control your mind because it is yours, you know. You can't let the fear control you because fear is just a warning light. Panic is loss of control. I think a lot of people panic, and that's hard to train.
I like that point because one of the things I do think that's highly valuable that you get from doing activities that some people will consider dangerous is learning to control fear and learning to control that panic response, because neither of those things are going to do you good elsewhere in life either. So we talked about you working at Yosemite. It did not end up being the dream job you thought it would be.
Oh, I don't think I thought it was a dream.
Or would not.
It's
or,
just a job. Job's
right.
A four-letter word.
Didn't turn out to be the dream move environment you hoped it would be. But it sounds like once you slid into Camp 4, and started leading that life, it did start to improve. And then you started
soloing
things.
Well, to a degree, but that was very temporary, you know? You can't maintain that. Once your money runs out, that's kind of it. I mean, obviously, some people can continue doing it.
And is that what caused you to leave, running out of money, or dealing with the limits?
I got really, really sick. My buddy Ryan Bracci and I climbed Royal Arches, and I felt funny. Something was wrong. I was climbing kind of crappy. The next day, I woke up at, I think, like 2 a.m., and I was vomiting. And I was vomiting for a couple of hours. Bad headache, and just felt really terrible. And I was like that for, I think, a couple of days before I just packed it in and left. While sick, drove back to Los Angeles.
So did it just turn out to be some sort of bug, or did it turn out to be something else?
I don't know. Every so often I get sick. I've got medical issues of my own, so it's kind of like, it's hard to diagnose sometimes. Sometimes it's from the past, and sometimes it's, you know, maybe should have washed my hands more that day or something.
Right.
I tend to be a pretty clean guy, you know, I'm careful with that, but who knows? Maybe I ingested something. I doubt it was food poisoning. It's probably not the pizza deck. And I've eaten at the pizza deck a billion times and never gotten sick, I think, so who knows, man?
Dude, you don't want the pizza deck coming after you.
No, they'll send the fat squirrels after you.
Yeah, they'll send the Stellar Jays to kick your ass.
They'll tear all the sausage off your pizza, and then what are you going
to
do?
So you came back to Los Angeles, where you still are. And I do remember not so long ago you claiming you were leaving Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah. I've been trying to move to the Pacific Northwest because it's more affordable. Just trying to make something happen. Plenty of times in my life I've been trying to make things happen, but I got a van, so I worked at Home Depot and I pushed shopping.
Wait, you got a van or you have a van?
I had a van.
Okay, because as far as I know, you have no vehicle right now other than a bike.
I have
correct?
An old BMW that I bought that is in storage at my buddy's house, and I feel bad for it, but he seems to be all right with it. So it's going to be that tenuous relationship. No, it's cool. I might sell that. It's a lot easier to live out of a van than it is out of a 36-year-old 3 Series, you know? It's pretty small. It's reliable, though. I had a van that I bought after I worked for about a year at Home Depot pushing shopping carts and doing trash runs and doing all the kind of the bitch work. And then I worked in the garden center, and that was a lot better because I like plants. Bought the van, had a little bit of money, and then about a week before I was going to drive up north and begin a trip, I was going to climb stuff along the way, which I've been doing for a few years now, doing the whole climb up, you know, go somewhere and then climb things along the way, which is pretty cool. The engine blew on the freeway and it got towed, and I didn't have enough money to swap a new 302, and it was an old Ford Econoline. It would have been a 302 Windsor. Couldn't fix it. I couldn't pull the engine out, and so I took all my stuff out of it, and I was trying to figure out what to do. So then I was like, okay, I'm trying to sell it. I was trying to sell it, and then I got a ticket on it, and they said, if you don't move it, which I can't move it. It was parked in a spot on the street, and the homeowners association are a bunch of Nazis, as always. Point is, couldn't even give it away in time for free, and the towing company took it, and they said, we will work with you on the price. I paid $1,300 for this 40-year-old van. I go to them. They want $1,500 to get it out of impound. And that would mean that it is sitting in front of their place in City of Industry, California, and I wouldn't have any money to take it in a tow truck to a piece of property that I don't own to then swap an engine into it, you know? So I had to let it go. And I got that van after my first BMW, an E30, a 3 Series, was lost in Crystal Lake in a flash flood. So that was my previous car.
Oh, wait, I think I remember. That was a few years ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, tell us about that. Tell us how that happened.
My buddy and I went up Route 39 a good distance, and we're just chilling out. He's not much of a hiker, so we're just chilling out, had a couple beers, sat out, and there was a kind of, you know, sometimes in summer we have thunderstorms and they gather up by the crest, and we went up there and we're just hanging out, drinking beers, watching the thunder and lightning. It's like, that's cool. And then the next day I thought, I'm gonna go up there tomorrow to Crystal Lake because I wanted to experience it more. And so I brought my climbing gear, I loaded my haul bag up, and I was gonna go aid a crack there that I don't think I've climbed yet. Yeah, I don't think I've climbed it. It's really bad, but it would have been okay on aid. Get there, it's okay, storm's building. And then thunder and lightning, you know, kind of far away, and it got closer and closer, and then it was pouring like mad, you know, really bad, actual storm, not like, you know, Southern California, Los Angeles rain, but you know, mountain storm. And thunder and lightning were not overhead, but they were very close. And so I got all my crap, I put it in my bag, I clipped it to a cam that I stuck in this like little roof that was just above ground level, and I waited. I was like, I don't know what the hell you're waiting for between lightning strikes, you know, that were probably about 500 meters away, not that close, but you're freaked out, so it's whatever. And the whole hillside's sliding away with the amount of rain that's coming down. And so I'm like, okay, I'm gonna go. And I ran down the hill to the lake, ran along the left side of the lake until I ran out of juice, and I was just like, okay. And I kind of slowed to a jog, and then I walked back to the parking lot, got in my car, relaxed a little bit. It's a one-way road right there. And I thought, okay, I'll just go down the road. And instead of, you know, I should have thought maybe I should just go the opposite direction, but I didn't know this because it's a lot shorter to go the wrong way. Another good reason to break the law in some cases for your own safety. So I went the correct way, and it was okay. E30 BMWs, by the way, with the M20, which is the inline six engine, they're famous for having a very low oil pan. The oil pan was probably like 6 inches off the ground. You break the oil pan, all the oil comes out. You need to shut the engine off or you have no engine. So that car, you're paranoid as hell not to run over any rocks. So I'm driving down that road, and there's, you know, debris on the road, so I'm dodging it, being really careful, going really slow, you know. But there's one part. There's only one part in the whole area that gets flooded, and there was some debris in there, and I tried to get through it, and I got stuck, and I'm like, shit. Tried to back out, got stuck, and there's stuff building up, and then I got walled in. I got yuccas and logs and rocks and everything up against the passenger side. I couldn't open the door anymore. I couldn't go anywhere, so I said, okay, whatever. Turn it off, close the windows up. I left my helmet in the car, came back, got it the other day, and I got out the passenger side. I jumped from the passenger side onto the side of the road because there was a dry spot. Closed the door. Think I might have locked it. I don't know. And then I had to go forward, then down, and then cross over a spot where I wouldn't have been swept away by debris because there's a shit ton of water. It turns out that one spot that floods is the drainage for the Crystal Lake wall, the one that I worked on. Then I walked back, and a nice guy named, I think his name was Mike, and he's a radio dude and a volunteer with the Forest Service up at Crystal Lake. And so he works with Adam and stuff. He's a really nice guy. Gave me a ride back. I went over to talk to Adam, and he was like, oh, you're all right? And I used his phone and made sure I called my mom and said, hey, I'm okay. But I lost Klaus. Klaus was the name of my our car. My buddies and I bought it. Going to build it into a race car or whatever. Then I got a ride down, got dropped off. A few days later, Randy Wirth and a whole bunch of us, about 9 or 10 of us, we all went up there, brought like a 12-pack of cheap beer, dug it out, and Randy pulled it out with his Land Cruiser. Got it out of the huge, you know, out of the flood zone and pulled it off to the side and came back a couple days later or a day later or something with AAA and towed it back to the house. And then I spent the next week getting hundreds of pounds of sand and yuccas and sticks and everything out of every part of the car. It turned over, but the exhaust was plugged with sand, so I only got a couple cranks out of it, and then that was it. And I sold it for $250 to a kid whose dad was German and seemed skeptical of the sale. They stuck it on a trailer, and at the last minute, the oil pan broke. Dumped its oil on, and it was like Klaus was saying goodbye to me. He's like, bye car, dad. Here's a bunch of oil in front of your neighbor's house.
And now you stick to bicycles.
Yeah, you know, it's much more affordable.
So how is that? Because you primarily get around on bike, whether it be in the mountains or on the road.
Mm-hmm.
You live in West Covina, right? Which is like eastern edge of Los Angeles. You travel based on where you can get on your bike or where somebody can drive you. So what's that radius look like around where you live that you're willing to take the bike? How far away do you go?
As far as you are motivated.
How far are you motivated to go?
What am I doing? What do I want to do? Like I rode up the 395 to go to Yosemite, and I've ridden to Yosemite twice now, up the coast a little bit. I do a lot of shorter rides, but I mean, you could ride around the world as long as you can ride on the surface.
So, I mean, Yosemite to West Covina, that's quite a distance on a bicycle.
It's like a week.
Yeah, so let's talk about what that looks like. Pack a bunch of stuff on your bike. Where are you sleeping along the way? What are you doing along the way to get there and back?
Just anywhere.
Just anywhere?
Yeah, being a little kid and sleeping in the hills, digging a foxhole kind of thing, or, you know, just sleeping under a tree or whatever. It's the same thing now. So people think it's wild. Like, you're cowboy camping. Aren't you afraid of bugs? And it's like, what's going to happen? How long have we been sleeping on the ground? For how many years have humans and other animals been sleeping on the ground? It's not like you're suddenly going to wake up and you have thousands of poisonous spiders on you and you have no money and everybody hates you. All a tent does is give you a place to be naked for like 10 minutes, you know? And I don't fit in tents because I'm tall, so it's like, whatever. And they're expensive and you have to carry them. There's nothing cool about that. They're great if it's raining, but you know. Last trip, let's see, first day I rode through Rancho, you know, up to Cajon Pass. I pushed the bike with the trailer up some really terrible dirt roads that were washed out and super screwed up to Phelan, you know, Cajon Summit, whatever, the edge of the desert. And then I rode to a place where I used to go shooting a lot as a kid near Kramer Junction. And so that was about 100 miles. And I just slept on the ground because I've been sleeping on the ground up there for a long time. And then the next day, where did I ride to? Place where I bought the pickle. I bought a pickle and a beer at this one place, Kozo Junction, I think it is, off the 395 north of the 14. And I slept on a bench.
Anybody throw any change at you?
Yeah.
You walk by?
I was playing my harmonica and my acoustic guitar. Everybody knows I love acoustic guitars. I was playing them both at the same time, and some guy told me to get a box and threw me 38 cents.
So you're hauling a trailer. So what's in that trailer? Climbing gear?
Yeah, I had less stuff than last year because that was my first real bike tour. So this year I had less stuff on the bike, so the bike itself didn't weigh as much. But in the trailer I had a huge Tupperware, and yeah, I had enough gear to climb pretty much any alpine or trad route, including anything with ice. I brought like 5 ice screws. I had my boots. I had my crampons, ice tools. I had a double rack to 3 with a number 4.
So wait, what time of year was this?
This is summer.
Fall or this summer?
But I figured if I was going to go stay with a friend up near Portland.
Oh,
and
so
Mount Hood is there.
Okay, you were going that far up.
yeah. north as well. Okay.
The Cascades were there, and I was looking for a job as just anything I could at an outdoorsy kind of company, you know? So it's like, well, I definitely want to climb the North Face of Hood. There's some cool stuff on that. Any type of technical, interesting route. So I brought all that stuff. It wasn't that bad. Previous year and all the biking I'd done was good training. So yeah, it's slower and it's harder than other things. But if you want it, it's not that bad.
I imagine it's a very different experience traveling on a bike a long distance versus a car.
It's 8 million times better. And I love cars and I love driving, not commuting, not boring driving on the freeway, but, you know, twisty roads and all that stuff. I still like bikes way more for that, because when you're in a car, it is not about the journey. You can say it's about the journey, but where are you going to stop? You know, like we go to drive to another state for like a race or something like that. You're going to stop at like, you know, some gas station or like a fancy gas station or a truck stop. And so it's like, yeah, wow, the journey is great. I've got a Snickers bar and ice cream and a Monster, as opposed to riding on your bike. You can smell everything. You see the sunrise. You see the sunset. You see animals, you see roadkill, you get to talk to people you would never talk to before, you become a better person, you open up to people, people open up to you, you help people who have car problems on the side of the road. You're engaged in the world as opposed to just being in the steel cage where you've got climate controlled music. It's cheaper too. Your fuel is your food, and food feels so much better when you're, you know, when you're hungry. But from climbing, dude, you get up, you're on some ledge like five pitches up and you're like, man, I'm really hungry. Oh wow, this thing that if I ate it at home would be lame. I'm eating it here. This is the best meal of my life. You get that every day. It's incredible. Rich. I don't really have any regular conventional goals in life, but I'd like to ride around the world, experience that, talk to people all around the world, and really be immersed in that.
You got to get those Instagram Rich. Likes up so you can get different sponsors.
I was
to
hoping
pay for
I'd
that.
Get sponsored by like Heinz or like Ragu, you know, something completely irrelevant, but maybe like, yeah, we'll sponsor you right across Africa if you just have all our mustard the whole way. You know what I mean? Just better. It's time, and obviously, most people don't have the time. You know, you might have a weekend and you want to go to Yosemite, so you got to drive, and it's 6.5 hours there, 6.5 hours back. Unless you're taking the 123.95, then it's add another half hour or so. On a bike that's a week, who the hell has a week nowadays?
So how's that working for you? Do you quit a job and then you do whatever you want to do until you run out of money and then you start
basically,
a new job?
I save up my money when I work. I sell whatever I have that I can that would provide enough, you know, money to help. I do side jobs. I wouldn't be able to do any of that stuff if I didn't do side jobs, like working on people's cars or whatever it might be. Save all that up, get the bike ready, make sure your sleeping kit is good, get some food things sometimes, and then just put the rest away. If you don't have a car, like I have a car, but it's in storage, I don't have registration, I don't have to pay for insurance, it's not being driven, I don't have to pay for gas, I don't have to pay for wear and tear, I don't have to pay for tires, I don't have to pay for brakes, I don't have to do this and that. It's cheap.
All right, so we're talking about Ragu sponsoring spaghetti around the world with
Ryan
Basie.
Yeah. How far could you get on a bike if you're, say, riding from coast to coast in the United States if all you were able to drink was Mountain Dew? Probably about 150 feet before your heart explodes and you die and your teeth fall out. But hell of a sponsorship, you know?
But hey, Ryan Dacey, he's willing to give it a try.
I'll do it,
you're
boys.
Willing to pay for it.
Just pay for the medical bills. That's probably not going to happen. All right. Don't bury me. Just cremate me, please.
I think they'd be more willing to pay for all of your gear for 5 years versus your medical.
So how long does it take to recover from binging on Mountain Dew? If I survive, it's probably going to take a while to get that fitness back and my teeth and everything. So it might be bad.
Yeah, it might be bad.
Get some good gear out of it. Whatever. I'm good. I'll do it.
You get to ride around the U.S. for 150 feet.
Sign me up, fam.
We've hit up climbing. We've hit up bikepacking. We even talked about you taking ladies on a sense of things.
Yeah, but... Okay, as a disclaimer, most of my family is women. I'm around women all the time. It's
so you're
just,
saying
it's
you're
easy.
Not a creeper, is what you're
Hell
saying?
Hell no.
You're not trying to get dates?
No.
You just prefer the company of
I'm a dirtbag.
Women?
I'm undateable. No, not really. It is different between men and women, but nothing replaces your homeboys, man. Just talking shit, hanging out with your homies, you can say anything. You guys are idiots together. It's great. It's a little different with women. Some of my lesbian friends, if that's an appropriate way to coin it, I don't know anymore. They normally don't give a shit. They're freaking outrageous. I love hanging out with lesbians. They're funny as shit.
Oh, so if we could get Ragu to pay for spaghetti around the world with Ryan Dacey and his lesbian friends.
As long as I'm in charge of the recording and it doesn't become a reality TV show. It has to be terrible. It has to barely be safe for public consumption.
All right. So before we wrap everything up, I seem to recall, and I don't remember very much about it, and we haven't talked about canyoneering much.
Oh, yeah. That's actually a big thing.
All right. So is that a thing you want to talk about?
Yeah. Because there's not a lot of climbing in the San Gabes. I can sum it up pretty quick. Not a lot of climbing in the San Gabes. A lot of canyons, though. So go out and explore canyons.
The end.
And I've checked a lot of them out. Most of them are not that great, but there's some pretty cool ones. My friend Amanda Kraft and I've done a lot of first ascents. She's one of my best partners. We've found some pretty cool stuff. Found like probably the biggest waterfall in the San Gabe's, Schwaterfall Canyon over by Rattlesnake Peak, kind of, sort of. It's like a 300-foot rappel or something like that. A lot of neat stuff out there. Some of the coolest stuff was on Smith Mountain and all burned up. There's these big ferns that are about 6 feet tall. They're all gone. Everything's gone. The whole ecosystem's gone. That really sucked.
So one thing,
Fish
that,
Fork.
That's what I was going to ask you about. I know you've got a good Fish Fork story.
But is that the final thing, is the Fish Fork story?
Unless you got something else you want to hit before that.
Joseph Munaretto, also known as Zay for Jose short. He lives up, I think, in the Bay Area right now. He's got a family. He started a family. He's a real nice guy. He's an expert on fitness, for lack of a better term, because I don't know the real, you know, fancy boy words, kinesiology or, you know, sports doctor, whatever. He was real interested in it. He had a big kick about exploring mines and stuff at the San Gabe's, because there's a lot of mines. There's a lot of cool history, you know, Old Western Jeremiah Brown kind of stuff, you know.
And tell people what Fish Fork is, how it differs from any other canyon in the area.
Well, Fish Fork is the long canyon that runs east-west along the San Antonio Ridge between Mount Baldy to Iron Mountain in the San Gabe's. It's like Eaton Canyon on steroids, but with 1/1,000,000th the human traffic, very little human impact back there except for airplane crash parts. It's really beautiful and it's shaded, so it's really cold there all year long. Sometimes there is a great deal of water, and it's, for someone like me, I'm not much of a swimmer, and so my canyoneering, I usually like it to be just moist canyoneering or dry like Death Valley. It's pretty challenging for someone like me.
The season when it's runnable tends to be much smaller than other canyons in the area, right?
Yeah, I would run it when it's hot at the end of summer. First time we did it, you usually do it about September 11th. So if you never forget September 11th, then go out there and spend, I would say, 3 days is the best way to experience it. Because you get to chill, you get to see it. It's untouched San Gabriel, semi-alpine, mountainy, quiet, cold, pure drinking water, beautiful, nice place with dope rappels and jumps and lots of swimming. There's like one or two water slides, which are really cool. It's really awesome. It's outstanding. It's my favorite canyon in the whole area. It's just that it's a big pain in the ass and I almost drowned in it. So it's got a lot of fear in there for me.
So back to your story about your buddy.
Oh yeah.
To do it.
Joseph wanted to, he's like, oh, I wonder what it's like out there. And he's like, oh, do you think it's, you know, requires a rope? And then my buddy Zach Cyrus, he's a real close buddy of mine. He's like, yeah, we should go check it out. And so we were like, all right, let's go check it out. We were both climbers. We're not canyoneers. We'd probably done Eaton Canyon a handful of times. And you know, the usual ones right over here and, you know, all that stuff that everybody's done. But we had a dynamic rope. We didn't bring any helmets. Don't ask me questions. I'll fight you IRL. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. It would have gone off without a hitch if any one part would have been different, but that's the same as anything else, really. It was just Zach and I on our first time down. We went up from the northern side, I think it's Cabin Flat or something like that, hiked over the Dawson Peak or whatever trail it is, into the eastern section of Fish Fork at Lower Fish Fork Camp. I think it's upper or lower. You could show it to me and I'd still screw up the name. I always do. First day, let's see, we did a handful of rappels. We got to the one section where you've got two rappels in a row and then like an optional slide or a down climb or a rappel. That area is really pretty. We went through the water in there and it started getting dark, so we backtracked and we bivvied under a tree with there were tons of spiders everywhere. A lot of undergrowth and crap. Next day, woke up, did that rappel. It looked super huge in the dark, and we do it, and it was super casual. It was really nice, really pretty. Kept going, bunch of rappels, bunch of swims. It's a really long canyon. I think it's like 8 miles long.
Just the technical section?
Before you get to East Fork. The last mile or so is completely non-technical. You're walking over slippery rocks in the easiest section, and it's just long. It's like generally one mile an hour, so 8 hours just to get through the canyon part of it, not counting anything else. We got to the longest rappel, and I was uneasy about it, and it's about 90 feet, and it looks really big, and it's numbers wise it's only, again, like 90 feet maybe, but there's a drowning machine at the bottom of it. And again, I'm not a very strong swimmer, and I was less strong then. That prompted me to become a stronger swimmer, and I got a little bit more serious about canyoneering afterwards. So let's see, set the rappel. We weren't the first people down. There was no information online about this, no information in any book that we had ever heard of about this canyon. So we found the first rappel anchor was ancient webbing. It was probably like, well, not ancient, but you know, like 5 or 10 years old. And so occasionally we would find old stuff, but a lot of that canyon gets scoured out. The hallway with the big chalk stone, that one gets scoured. The anchors are in a different place every year. So anyway, the big rappel, set the anchor, new one, wrapped down. I'm on a dynamic rope and I'm wearing BDUs, you know, military clothing, because it worked. And I had it. That's all cotton, and that got soaked, and there's no sunlight, and it's really cold water. At the bottom, I tried to swim away. I had my pack on, probably weighed about 60 pounds because everything was soaking wet. And I'm trying to swim away from it when I got off rope, and I'm getting slowly pulled back. So I'm making negative progress. It's extremely loud, and it's very cold, and it's really hard to communicate with Zach at the top of the pitch. I realized this wasn't working, so I made a prusik, and I stuck my pack to the base of the rope, and I thought, okay, I don't know how he's going to get down, but I'm going to try to swim anyway, see if I make any progress. I didn't make any progress again. I was getting pulled back, and it was really tiring me out. So I get back on the rope, put myself on, pull in as much slack as I can, and it being a dynamic rope, it would stretch, and so no matter what, no matter how much work I did, I was always going to be sitting in the water, and the water is cold, it's getting later, it's late afternoon, and you're in the shade the entire time, and the water is really cold, and you're tired, and this is day two of an unknown canyon, which is really big, and I'm a bad swimmer, so on and so forth, and so I was not comfortable, and so at that point, I think he asked, do I need to use a spot? He brought a spot device, and I said yes, and so he pressed the emergency button on there, the 911 button, so I stayed down there, and we were kind of yelling back and forth, because it's super loud. It sounds like a helicopter is not super close, but close enough that you can't hear. He and I were yelling back and forth what we should do, and so he eventually said, okay, I'm going to go figure something out. So he left his stuff at the top of the rappel. He went back up the canyon. He went up a slope, across, down another slope, upriver, climbed up a rappel, which was in a small waterfall, which is super slippery, and right now I still can't believe he did that. And he got to me after about, I think, 2 hours of being in the water, and I was hallucinating, and I was hypothermic, and my skin was changing colors, and I was exhibiting signs of hypothermia, and I was kind of losing it. I thought that a helicopter had been overhead a bunch of times previously, but it wasn't. It was just the water, and I was hallucinating. He took all of his crap off, and so it was just him in his shorts, and he swam out, and he got me, and he brought me out. He's a really strong swimmer. He's a really strong dude. He's an EMT. You know, he's a nurse, so he started telling me what to do. You know, okay, I need you to change in your clothes right now, and I was just kind of like, hey, thank you so much. Man, it was really cold, you know, I was being stupid.
Right.
And so he's like, no, you need to change. And he was, you know, telling me what to do and got me all changed. And there's a picture of me changing, and it's great because I look totally out of it. And I think I still have that picture somewhere on the internet.
I hope
and,
so, because you're going to send it to me.
Oh, okay. Well, it might be on the trip report on the San Gabriel Forum. This is a little while, probably about an hour or two before sunset. And it was September 9, I think, 2009, 2011, 2010. I don't know. One of those times. We pulled the rope, got everything out, and then we went down, wrapped the thing he climbed up, got over, and there's a scree slope with a big old oak tree next to it that goes northward. Put our crap down there, and he said, hey, I gotta go get my pack. I left it way up there. So he goes up that scree slope, around the corner, and probably gained about 1,000 feet, maybe 1,200 feet of gain, just doing that. Tons of work. It's really, that whole area, it's a lot of work. It's like the Sierra, if the Sierra is falling apart, so it's even more work. You know what I mean? Because you can't just climb up it. It's just swimming.
Right.
We had to come back and get our stuff a couple days after we got rescued. But he jumped into a helicopter from like the edge of a ridge. He found an airplane wreck somewhere up there. I'll have to ask him again someday where the heck it was, because I wouldn't mind seeing it, I guess. Hell, I really want to go back. And he jumped into the Huey, one of the L.A. County Fire Department Hueys, I think it was. West Valley SAR, I believe. And then they said, okay, I think we're done. He's like, no, my buddy's still down there. They didn't know I was down there. Now I'm at the, I'm
they,
just
they
chilling
just thought
out.
He didn't feel like doing it?
Yeah, no, it's fine. You can leave him. So then they sent a Firehawk, which is a Black Hawk that's converted to fire duty. So, you know, it's got like a bladder, and it's, you know, a little more Spartan, a little more rescue-centric. They came in, and it was dark then. We're right at the base of the north face or north ridge or north whatever aspect of Iron Mountain. And it's probably windy as hell. And it's probably a real challenge to be a helicopter pilot in that situation. The Black Hawk lowered one of the rescue dudes on the steel cable. I talked to him real quick. Hey, blah, blah, blah. Hey, you got to leave your stuff, because we couldn't bring the stuff up. I didn't have a helmet. He was obviously kitted out. He's all ready to go. Regular crew chief stuff with a avionics helmet or whatever. I had one of those full body harnesses that I put on. And then he clipped me into it. And we both went up. And it's dark out. And we got, I don't know how high off the ground before we started moving forward. And we started going north. When you go there, there's this massive, big-ass pine tree, and it dragged us through this pine tree, this huge, dead pine tree, and I slammed the back of my head on a branch. I've been punching the head a handful of times where I, you know, saw stars, and it was kind of time slowed down, and you have to start to relive again and be like, how will I hit this person or something? And it was just bam, and it's super, super bright. I don't think I've ever seen stars like that before, where everything was white, and then it twinkled back. And I remember it going, you okay? And he's like, yeah. He's the guy with the helmet. I didn't even have a freaking helmet on. Lifted us up. The pilot turned and headed southward and pulled us all the way up. And then I got a cool ride at night over the San Gabes in a Black Hawk by Iron Mountain. And you could just see the big shapes of big peaks and stuff. It was really cool. Adrenaline had worn off a while ago. Adrenal dump, which is fun. and all that stuff. And now you're just chilling, and they dropped us off at Brackett Field. And then I got picked up and went home, and my buddy Eric was there. Eric was just very recently in an incredibly bad car accident, so I wish I could go check him out after his issue. And he went and came over to me, and I couldn't stop dropping things. I couldn't remember stuff. Then I ate a bunch of macaroni and cheese. And I think I waited a while to go to sleep. And then a few days later, we came back and we retrieved our stuff, which was a 22-mile round trip that took all of a whole day to do.
What kind of macaroni and cheese?
It was Kraft, which isn't that great because I'm lactose intolerant.
Don't say it.
Oh, I need the sponsorship.
If Ragu
it was outstanding. It was Ragu. It was a really strange new variety. It was really good.
You just told a story where macaroni and cheese saved your life.
Yeah, well, it replenished me post
deal right there.
Problem. Yeah, I know. I totally bombed that. I'm sorry, Kraft. You guys
are
good.
That's why you can't get a goddamn sponsor,
son
dude.
Son of a bitch. Well, it's because I'm lactose intolerant. I don't know. I'm not Dutch or whatever.
Wait, Dutch? The only
the Dutch or the Danish have like really good enzymes in their guts for processing bovine breast milk, and I'm just a regular Central Eastern Northern European ass
South American
kid. Yeah, South America. I'm just a regular Venezuelan white boy.
Right, named Taco.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't get it.
As your parents named you.
Yeah, I don't know why, but it's cool. They're hippies, but different kind of hippies.
You were saying that's like 7-8 years ago, somewhere around there.
Something like that.
And then since then, you've been able to do canyons without getting rescued, right?
Yeah, well, shit, we've done Fish Fork. I've done it probably 4 or 5 times since. Probably closer to four. Haven't had any problems, but I remember the second time I did that rappel, I tasted fear, which I hadn't done in a long time. It's a really interesting experience. Have you ever like had that acrid taste that seeps into your mouth and it seems to come up from here?
It's kind of like bile coming back up from your throat or something different than that?
It would be kind of like bile, but it tastes different. I don't know how to describe it other than kind of acrid, but it's fear that's, you know, so present that it's you taste that. I'm not really sure what function that has.
Were you first down this time or had someone already gone down?
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure the second time we visited the canyon, I think that was a 3-day trip with Randy and Dominic, Kirk and Joanna, Anouk and myself, and I hope I didn't miss anybody.
Totally missed somebody.
And and I think Randy went down first with no gear. He just brought what he needed, and he's a good, strong guy, so he figured it out pretty
and
quick.
He's like 12 feet long.
Yeah, he's a long boy. He's a noodle boy. I love you, Randy, you asshole. I still have your wrenches. I'm not going to give them back. Yeah.
Wait, are these the wrenches that little crappy canyon we did that night and somebody threw his wrenches down the well? Is
I
that
think
what you're
so.
Talking about? Are those wrenches?
You mean where we were learning how to place bolts?
Yeah, wasn't that
I placed like
2 years ago?
A quarter of a bolt. Was it 2 years ago?
I don't know. It was a long time ago, dude.
All I know is Alden, when
yeah,
you come
Alden
back.
Alden was still here. So
and
it
before
was at
we
least,
go on a bike yeah. trip, let's have some adult beverage canyoneering experiences at night. Again, I miss those despite the next day being hell. Because, you know, I got like an hour of sleep.
All right. So from there, you've become a competent canyoneer.
I've become a safe canyoneer with parallels with my climbing aptitude on loose rock. I don't like water that much. I'm not a big canyoneer. I just like to explore, and I like to explore things that are technical because it adds a mental element to it as opposed to just hiking. Did plenty of hiking before. I'm kind of over it. There's still canyons that I've got on my list to do up here in the San Gabes that, as far as I've known, have never been done either because they're really big or because no one gives a damn about them, and they would be cool.
So what's the future looking like right now?
My future or?
My future. Could you tell me what
well,
my
you know,
future
I don't know, for like San Gabriel exploring or?
Yeah, your future. So you're currently working some job over here in Pasadena that you had to work today.
Yeah.
And you're actively trying to get up to the Pacific Northwest and you're interested in certifications. So sounds like there are a lot of hurdles there.
There's always
so,
hurdles,
so
yeah.
What's your goal right now? What are you trying to make happen?
I need to make more money.
What does that money allow you to do? Because
pay for
from what I've gathered, you're not a guy that cares about money.
Well, I don't chase it all that much, but I also have a good community that supports me, so I don't need to, you know, at the moment. My goal is to get first single pitch instructor. That's $750. My last paycheck was $192, so you can imagine for 2 weeks of work, it's going to take me a long time, and that's one thing. And there's no guarantee, obviously, that I'm going to pass single pitch. They always throw things at you. But train up for that with my buddy who just got his and is very competent with rope systems. Try to find work through that. I'd like to work outdoors. I've applied to a bajillion jobs recently, but one of them was Venture Cycling Association up in Missoula, Montana, because I thought I'm really good at planning trips, or at least I think so. I'm really good with maps. I'm good with all that kind of crap. And they didn't entertain it, but that's fine, I guess. Keep on trying. Just stuff like that. Probably going to stay local to LA. I got to take care of some things down here. I don't think I'm going to move to the Pacific Northwest, but I think I will be semi-nomadic as usual. And probably mostly off of a bike, because it makes sense and I enjoy it and it pushes me.
So if anybody wanted to follow along on your semi-nomadic travels, is that a thing they can do?
Probably Facebook, or better yet, I think Instagram. Yeah,
Instagram. Are you private on there?
I have my thing set to private, yeah. But if you add me, I let almost anyone add. It was mostly for work things, because even in low-paying jobs, you have to have this kind of bullshit professionalism thing around it that everybody's obsessed with, about like no beards and no joking around and, you know, being serious. And it's not like I have nude pictures or anything crazy on my Instagram, but, you know,
not nude pictures. I wouldn't say that you don't have anything crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, stuff that you won't see, like if you have an uptight manager or boss, they'd be like, you know, I don't approve of this because, you know, but it's Taco Del Montana. So TACODELMONTANA. If you want to follow that, that's cool. Or you can look me up on Facebook, I guess.
And if Ragu, Kraft, or one of those want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, they'll have to talk to my agent, Randy Worth. He's tall. He's an engineer. He's my agent. I pay him in cryptocurrency only. You can contact him at randyworth@randyworthengineering.edu.gov.
Great. So if anyone wants to get in touch with Taco/Ryan, they need to go through Randy Worth. And if you'd like to follow what he's doing, you need to go to his Instagram page. But first, you have to get him to accept your request, which you're on that stuff pretty frequently, so I don't think it'll take very long.
I like taking pictures. It's someday you're dead, and what do you have to show for it? So I've got photos people can look at and remember things.
I hope that your tombstone says, someday you're dead, and what do you got to show for it?
Stories. That's all it really lasts, I guess, you know?
So the way I usually end this show is I ask you if there's anything we've missed that you want to talk about, or if there's any final thought you want to leave people with.
Yeah, I got final thoughts. I hope they don't take too long. One thing that we didn't cover was the San Gabriel Mountain Forums, which I've given control of to my buddy Sean and Hike and Jim. Everybody knows about Hike and Jim. He's a stove expert, and they're both very competent, motivated guys who are really good at this kind of stuff. You know, recently with moving around a lot and changing things, I gave them control of the website that I've been running for a while.
What website is this?
The San Gabriel Mountain Forum. If you go at icepiraten.com, it means ice pirates in German. Good luck with that. EISPIRATEN. You'll see the stickers all over. I mean, we have stickers on top of like Lone Pine Peak, Whitney, all over the place, Everest Base Camp, a lot of stupid places, on some cars, all over the place, you know, because they last a long time. Mitch of Mesa Tactical, he made the stickers. He's a good guy. Those stickers are indestructible. But yeah, check that out. It's if you're in the San Gabes, if you're in LA and you want information, that's a treasure trove of information. It's outstanding. All user contributions. I don't make trip reports anymore. I don't like blogs. I don't like writing stuff very much. I like to kind of keep it inside and I take pictures instead. Maybe talk to somebody. Probably not. I keep everything inside mostly. I shouldn't probably, but whatever. But for a while, I put a lot of stuff on there. So there's a lot of good info on like Fish Fork. If you want to go do Fish Fork, which I would say be a good swimmer and be competent, and having done a lot of classy canyons would help, and have your head screwed on tight.
Yeah, don't wear cotton.
Don't use that dynamic rope.
Maybe bring a wetsuit.
Nah, honestly, that one, there's so much walking in between wraps that a wetsuit just gets you hot and it's uncomfortable. I just wear fast drying light wool and swim trunks, and then bring warm clothes to switch into that you can switch into that are in a dry bag, but you can still access quickly. And then I guess final thoughts.
Yep, let's hear those final thoughts. I mean, unless what you want to leave people with is someday you're dead and what do you got to show for
it? Yeah, well, that was just off. That was
wise words from Ryan Dacey.
I don't know, man. I did think of just kind of the topic of knowledge to pass on. It's hard for me to say because I lead a different life from a lot of people. You know what I mean?
It's all right. This is about you, about the life you lead. Maybe somebody else wants to lead the Dacey life and climb the Dacey routes.
Oh, God. Well, in that case, I would say the dream is just to lead a lifestyle where you have a good balance, work with income that's enough to pay for housing, which is outrageous, your hobbies and food. Just try to exercise a lot. Eat right. Don't depend on substances like alcohol for unwinding.
For joy.
Yeah, I mean, don't not drink by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I think people need to exercise more and just eat less crap and get more sleep. I think the society is very sleep-deprived, and I think that's a huge problem.
Dude, we don't need sleep. We have coffee.
Yeah, we'll just use drugs to counteract the effects of 8-million-hour work weeks.
All right, so is that what you want to leave everybody with?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like, is there anything I should say?
I mean, no, you just say whatever the hell you want.
I'll be riding my bike home in a minute, and I'll be like, shit, I should have said blah, blah, blah. Whatever, we'll figure it out. You guys will figure it out. You know, use your best judgment. Don't be a bitch. Love your friends. Make sure you tell everybody that you love them before you can't, because, you know, people die. So make sure you tell your friends you appreciate them, because you lose friends every year, you know what I mean? See your people. Love your people.
So on that oddly happy and depressing note.
Well, hopefully good. It's just a reminder, and all reminders have some weight.
All right. So if you're happy with that, I think we can call it good.
Let's do it.
And then you can get on your bike and try to get home before it's completely dark.
Oh, it'll be fine. I'm going to take the train.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll get down on the gold lines pretty
lazy
tight.
Ass.
Night creatures.
All right, dude. Well, thanks for meeting me over here.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for waiting for me to piss twice.
Now you're going to have to say tight now. It's going to be a habit.
Yeah,
getting everybody to do it.
Yeah, it's tight, dude. It's tight. Fucking tight.
Dope. Adios.
I would like to request that every single person out there right now who is listening to this episode head on over to the Ragu website or contact Ragu in any way that you know how and let them know that you want to see Ragu's Spaghetti Round the World with Ryan Taco Dacey. Let them know you want to see that happen. Let Ragu know that they need to sponsor Taco del Montaña. And while you are pestering Ragu at whatever their website is, probably ragu.com, while you are doing that, why don't you head on over to our website, gogetoutside.com/podcast, and look for this episode 61 with Ryan Taco Dacey. And there you will find links to his Instagram, blog, East Piratin, his Mountain Project page, information on Fish Fork, and most importantly, Yelp reviews for Taco del Rio, the restaurant he named himself after. But you will also find photographs, and as is always the case with Ryan Dacey, you'll at least get a good chuckle off of his photographs. So head to the website, check those out, and then go ahead and drop us a line here at the show, go@butcherbirdstudios.com if you like to use email. But if you prefer technology developed long, long ago in the past and you'd rather call us up and leave a voicemail, you may do that at 818-925-0106. And if you would like for me to have a great beginning to my 2018, then please do me a personal favor. Head on over to your podcast purveyor of choice. Subscribe to this show, rate this show, review this show, and share the wonderful words of Ryan Taco Dacey with someone you love. The Go Get Outside podcast is produced and recorded by me, your host, Jason Milligan. This episode was edited by Griffin Davis with additional editing by me and brought to you by Butcher Bird Studios. Next time on the show, it's time for another roundtable discussion. Come back and learn everything you need or want to know about bikepacking and touring. January 16th, Bikepacking and Touring Roundtable. See you then.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.